Is the theater industry discriminating against white people? Well, in reaction to the uprisings, shall we say, of 2020, the American theater has vowed to address the white supremacy that's just roiling within. Many say it's a long overdue reckoning, a cultural revolution, if you will, aimed at righting the wrongs of the past. But insiders tell me that morale is low, that frustration is high, and that some are suddenly struggling to find work because they're the wrong skin color. Well, few will discuss this third rail topic for fear of cancellation, but one man has had enough. Kevin Lynch is a man of the theater. He is a writer, composer, conductor, musician, music director, producer, and YouTuber who's been ruffling feathers by speaking out about what he feels is an open culture of anti-white racism in the theater community, even taking legal action to deal with the issue. We had a very lively conversation about his legal battles, the ongoing Broadway brain drain, whether or not the course can ever be corrected, and more. I was shocked by what I heard. Stick around and you will be too. But first, hello there, ladies, gentlemen, and as always, everyone in between. My name is Clifton Duncan. This is my podcast. Thank you so much for joining me for yet another fascinating conversation that lives at the intersection of art, entertainment, culture, and society. However you're consuming this podcast, be it Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you prefer to scratch your CDP itch, please do me a favor, leave me a like, a comment, or a review. If you're watching on YouTube, I would deeply appreciate you if you took the extra step and subscribed. And as always, you can help this podcast and this community grow by sharing this show as much as humanly possible. If you love it, share it with your friends. And if you hate it, then share it with your enemies. You can also find my verified account on Rumble, where I have exclusive content you literally cannot find anywhere else. So be sure to sign up there and support me on Locals while you're at it. The links will be in the show notes. Lastly, if you'd like to support me and really make my day, you can buy me a bag of Skittles via PayPal, Venmo, Cash App, or buy me a coffee. I'm turning ads off on these podcasts for YouTube. They're annoying anyway, and we're going to see what happens. So if you want to support another way, you can buy me some Skittles, metaphorically speaking, because I shouldn't be eating them because they have way too much sugar. And I probably have some kind of weird addiction to them. Anyway, all the links will be in the show notes. Stay tuned. My conversation with Kevin Lynch starts right after these very important messages. You know, part of my job as an artist is understanding the world around me, but with all the bias and noise, it's tough to make sense of anything. Enter Ground News. For pennies a month, this amazing aggregator brings you the hottest current events from outlets all over the world, left, right, and center, and emails you every day to shine light on your blind spots, stories you might have missed due to your own biases. You can install their web extension to learn which way a news site leans and download the Ground News app to get your news on the go. I love this service, friends, and I'm happy to provide loyal listeners of the Clifton Duncan podcast 15% off of an already unbeatable price. Head on over to check.ground.news/Clifton Duncan. Again, head to check.ground.news/Clifton Duncan to get 15% off of Ground News. Get yourself a bird's eye view on world events. Twin Engine Coffee is grown in the gorgeous sunny mountains of Nicaragua, where it's selected, roasted, and packaged before being shipped right to your door. Not only is their bold and aromatic coffee delicious, Twin Engine also employs farmers, tasters, printers, retailers, packers, suppliers, and artists in the local community. Did you know that 99% of the world's coffees are grown in the world's poorest countries? Well, by purchasing Twin Engine Coffee, you are not only treating yourself to the best cup of joe around, you are helping these wonderful people to lift themselves out of poverty. Support small business, support the Clifton Duncan podcast, and support the good people of Nicaragua by ordering from twinenginecoffee.com/Clifton Duncan. Again, that is Twin Engine Coffee at twinenginecoffee.com/Clifton Duncan.
Are you an artist or a lover of art and entertainment who's dismayed by what they've become? Are you trying to understand what's gone wrong? Do you wish someone would tell the truth about what's happening? Then check out my newsletter, The State of the Arts. The State of the Arts is an arts-first publication that features cutting cultural commentary from a heterodox perspective. It's free to read with perks for paid subscribers. Go to cliftonduncan.substack.com to read The State of the Arts. Again, that is The State of the Arts at cliftonduncan.substack.com.
I'm ready for action.
Okay. That's what she said. Kevin Lynch. Hello. Hello again, my friend. How are you doing today?
I'm doing as good as I could be.
Well, I think we'll get into that. So I'm going to go right to the races. Now, you made a video some months ago entitled Broadway is Discriminating and I'm Over It. What inspired this video?
Well, it started, so that video came out of months of frustration, not only with the Broadway industry, but just theater as a whole on the East Coast. Even in like community theater circles that I'm part of, and some of the regional theaters that I'm part of, there's an overwhelming acceptance of blatant discrimination in most of the advertising of positions, mostly in the musical theater pits, specifically against white men. And it started really back in February of last year. There was a post in a Facebook group that I'm part of for music directors, and it was posted by someone who works at a university in New Jersey, Montclair State University. And they were looking for a music director, so it was a paid job, but they were strongly looking for someone who didn't belong as part of the global majority or minority. So they were essentially looking for non-white men to fulfill this role. And I was really, just as a person without history and knowledge of race and all that stuff involved, it's just as a person that's just morally wrong to me that we're making hiring decisions based on someone's physical characteristics and attributes. So that really pissed me off back in February of last year. So I took a screenshot of it and I posted it on my Facebook publicly. And I reported Montclair to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for discrimination. So I filed a claim of discrimination against them for blatantly advertising that they are looking for people who aren't white and who aren't male to fulfill this role. So I was really just aggravated about that whole thing. Not only for me, because I wouldn't have taken the job anyway, because I just, you know, I had other things going on at the moment. So, but just for my fellow man and friends of mine who are actively looking for jobs like this, who now know that they're going to be overlooked because of their skin color, regardless of whether you're white or like, it doesn't matter what the color is. So I made this post and I got a lot of pushback, naturally, from a lot of the university people. And a couple days went by and the president of Montclair reached out to me personally through a text message and an email apologizing and told me that, you know, asked me if I could take down what I posted because they have taken down what they posted and that they're working on it internally, whatever that means, and to kind of backtrack what I was doing. And so I did, because they took it down. I was like, you know what? I don't want to start any more, you know, problems. So we'll just, I walked it back. But in doing so, a few months later, there was another post. I think Carmel Dean posted something. There was like five composers for this fellowship that were selected.
And who is Carmel Dean? Sorry to cut in.
She's in the Broadway community. I think she's a writer. She's part of Maestra. She's in the writers' guilds of Broadway. And she posted something about the people who got awarded this fellowship for composing, and she commented saying, "Oh, they happen to be white." You notice that all of them are white men, and I was like, I got really annoyed by that too, and I commented under it, and I said, you know, just because there's smoke doesn't mean there's a fire. Just because you think that, just because it appears that they're all white men doesn't mean that, you know, other people are overlooked, or that there's some weird, mysterious Wizard of Oz guy pulling the strings behind the curtains, trying to, you know, rig the whole thing in favor of white men. And so I commented on that. And then people started coming after me, including Georgia Stitt, who is the founder and president of Maestra, which is how we're getting to that question you asked me. She wrote a comment to me and another Broadway pit musician who was also like, you know, what is this crusade about? And she told us that our misogyny is showing, and that we need to. And she actually pointed me out and said, and told me, Kevin, you know, I'd be careful. I saw your post a few weeks back about Montclair State and your discrimination comments, and don't think they went unnoticed in the Broadway pits and in the people on Broadway, you know, and the people in the industry. And she actually said, good luck with your business and all the places you're advertising to get work and the people that are hiring you. And so I screenshotted that because, you know, I'm like, I'm going to keep an archive of this stuff because this is going to bite us in the butt at some point. And so I screenshotted that, and then I sent her a private Facebook message, and I told her, hey, look, you don't know me, I don't know you from a hole in the wall, but I'm reaching out to see if we could just have a conversation about this because I know our paths are eventually going to meet at some point in the future because we're both in this industry. And so that's what conspired back in like March of last year after the Montclair thing. So fast forward to June. And Maestra and MUSE, which stands for Musicians United for Social Equity, mostly that organization started just as a response from George Floyd and all that stuff that went down there. It was just a response and a reaction to that. And what they do is they're online directories that are claim as part of their mission to for to bring visibility, equity, inclusion, community to people of color, which is what MUSE is, and Maestra is for women and non-binary people who identify as those things. And what they are online directories. So if you're a music director or you're a producer or a music supervisor, and you're like, hey, I need, you know, a piano, bass, and drums and some strings for a show I'm doing, but I only want to hire. Maybe I want to hire women. So you go to Maestra and you check the box that I'm looking for women who identify as BIPOC or Asian, or you know, you check the boxes and it filters in this directory all these people. And you can hire and basically cherry pick people based on these characteristics, which are all out of our control. I was born white man. I can't change that about me. So all these, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
It sounds like you're saying that there is an organization in place that enables theater professionals to deliberately discriminate when in their hiring practices. Is that what I'm okay?
Absolutely. That's
Sounds illegal.
that. I mean, I'm speculating that it's illegal. I'm not a lawyer or attorney by any means, but my opinion is that I think it's illegal because you can't discriminate on the basis of race, gender, sex, sexual orientation, religion. All those things are protected by federal law. It's protected by the Civil Rights Act. So, and in the Civil Rights Act, it doesn't make mention of race, of which races have more protections over others. It's just people in general, which is what Martin Luther King was advocating. You know, he was advocating that we're judged based on the content of our character, not the color of our skin. And he, I mean, it was a different time. He was talking about, you know, people of color, but that applies to everyone. He just wanted everyone to be treated fairly. And today, with something like Maestra, to have, and granted, like I, you know, in listening to Georgia talk and other podcasts and stuff about why she started Maestra and that she was trying to find other women musicians to fill certain roles, she couldn't find any. So she started this massive database, which eventually, you know, was born into Maestra in 2017. And, you know, there's some things that they do that are really good. Like, I like that they have resources available to everyone of, you know, they have webinars and they have educational stuff for people who want to get into the industry. But in order to be part of their directory, they actually have to approve you. So you have to apply to the directory. It's not public facing until someone on the other end of the screen in the Maestra, you know, milieu decides to check the box that, okay, we're going to greenlight this person to be public in the directory. So, yeah, and Muse is the same way. Both websites are structured exactly the same. Muse is for people of color and Maestra is for women and non-binary people. There's no group for white men. So I'm prefacing that with in June of last year, Maestra and Muse in partnership with Wicked and the music department of Wicked created this experience extended to the people in their directory to apply so that way they could have a 3-week paid stipend intensive to shadow and basically work with the music department of Wicked to get experience and to network. And, you know, they had other perks like being able to play the one of the keyboard books for a show and being able to conduct a rehearsal or oversee rehearsals. Like, they had stuff like that, but it was a paid stipend thing extended to Muse and Maestra members. They publicly announced it for everyone, but, you know, again, it's, you know, a wolf in sheep's clothing trying to, you know, it's a front for what they're doing, for this blatant public and flagrant discrimination against people who do not subscribe to either of their directories. And so what I did was I applied and I got wise and I'm like, you know what, I'm going to apply anyway with their Google form and I'll join both directories, because as part of the application, as one of the required questions, you had to have a link to your profile in either of the directories. So I couldn't even hit submit on the Google form and leave those questions blank. I had to provide a link to the directories.
And there's no, and they were only looking for basically racial minorities and women. What about sexual minorities? I mean, outside of non-binary, which is a binary thing anyway, but let's
I know. I know. The hypocrisy of it all is just mine. I just don't understand. They're so blind to it. No, there was nothing about, I mean, they have LGBT and stuff as part of their boxes that they ticked. And the only reason I know that is because you could go on Maestra and you could use the search fields yourself and see what you could filter out. But what I did was I created a profile. I uploaded a photo. I put my biography. I put all my links. I put all the work I've done. I've worked at Juilliard. I'm currently going to Berklee. You know, I've done a lot. I've worked at Royal Caribbean, being a rehearsal pianist for the cruise ship shows. I taught high school. I mean, there's a lot I've done. And I'm music directed at least over 50 shows, regional stuff. I'm working on developing new musicals with creators and composers and stuff like that. I'm writing my own stuff. So, you know, I'm very active as a person in entertainment. And so I applied and a few days went by and I looked and I saw that I wasn't accepted into the Maestra directory yet. I searched my name and I'm like, my name's not there. It doesn't come up. So same with Muse. And to this day, I'm still not accepted into Muse, even though I still can log in. But I went into, so I emailed Georgia Stitt and I told her, I said, hey, look, you know, I reached out. I'm like, you know, I see I'm not in the directory yet and my profile is not public. You know, I applied. I'm just wondering what's going on, what's taking so long, what's the deal? And I heard nothing. And then that night I emailed Georgia, and within an hour of emailing her, I got an email notification from Maestra saying that my profile has been denied into the directory, and that there's either two reasons for that. The first one is either that my profile was incomplete, which isn't true. I have screenshots of that. Or that my profile did not demonstrate that I belonged as part of the Maestra community. And part of the criteria is that you have to upload a photo. So once I got that email, I sent another email to Georgia Stitt telling her, hey, look, I've offered to have a conversation with you one-on-one multiple times. It's gone unmet. You haven't reached out. You haven't communicated with me. You didn't even send an email reply. You have an obligation as a president of a non-for-profit organization to, talk about this. And her entitlement was showing, And so what ended up happening was I sent another email, and I heard no response. And then, about a month later, I got a denial email that my application was denied, but I was invited. I laughed. This really pissed me off. I was invited to apply again for any opportunity in the near future that Maestra and Muse may have for this wicked opportunity. Now, granted, there's never been anything like this, period, before. Broadway, getting into the pits of Broadway has always been about networking, contacting people, trying to get in backstage, trying to talk to people and see if you could shadow and just sit in a pit and watch, which I've done before. And so there's never been a pipeline into any of Broadway. It's always been networked and who you know, and they don't advertise, hey, we're looking for pit musicians for a new musical, come apply. It's never, ever been like that. And to have this opportunity be available and not allowed for a certain group, I'm like, it's just wrong. So I got that denial email, and then I sent a very, very strongly worded letter to Maestra and to Georgia, and I told them, I said, I believe that I've been discriminated against, and I'm going to file a claim of discrimination against you for what you're doing. And then I heard nothing. So I made that video, by the way, I made that video in June after I didn't hear back from them, and I'm being, stonewalled and ghosted, they're gatekeeping and doing all those colorful buzzword things that happen now. And so I made a video about, that Broadway's discriminating and I'm over it, because it's been months of just like seeing posts about, we're only looking for Black piano players for this show. And I'm like, you're discriminating. And people are like, yay, we love this. We love that you're giving opportunity. I'm like, first off, if you even get a chance to sit in a Broadway pit, you're already like privileged beyond most of the people in this freaking country. So the fact that the privileged few are saying they're not getting access and creating their own, it's like the rich creating their own rich club for only certain rich people. And it's like, but we're all you're all getting a part of this, but I haven't made my entrance on Broadway yet. So it's, I would like, that would be a great opportunity for me to be able to get selected to do something like that. Go ahead.
I think that a lot of people listening will hear your story and they'll say, well, okay, you signed up for a couple of organizations which explicitly said that these are the people that we're looking for, and now you are pissed off that they denied your application. On top of that, you mentioned the importance of networking and who you know, and I think part of the issue here, the challenge, and I've dealt with something similar as well, is that yes, it's nice when people are sort of looking out for you. If you happen to be, a racial minority, sexual minority, woman, or whatever, but at the same time,
I think the issue comes when you start, these top-down enforcements of these edicts and decrees that say you have to have this many number of people of this persuasion in your company. I think that's always a difficulty of it. But what would you say to people who say, well, okay, you saw what the criteria were and you applied anyway. Why are you so salty now?
Well, because they didn't explicitly say that it was just for their members. They extended it as part of their advertising that it was just they're extending this opportunity to their directory members and to other people who want to apply. But as part of their application, you had to have a link to either of their membership directories. So right out the gate, you can't, there's no, that would have been a perfect opportunity for anyone who wants to work on Broadway. And it's like, why just, I was really more annoyed because it was like, you're doing a paid stipend as well. So I was looking at it from, this is a 3-week paid intensive. And so you're discriminating against race for a paid opportunity. And to me, I interpreted that, which again, I'm not a lawyer, but I interpreted that as you're barring me from access to work. So yeah, I was really annoyed about the whole thing with that. And they like to hang their hat on, well, you're a white man, your ancestors have had it good all these years. It's like, I haven't had it good all those years. I was born in 1990. I wasn't around during the race riots and civil unrest with discrimination and segregation in the 60s. Like, I wasn't around during that. But, so it's like, why are we still doing this? Because we're still behaving in the same fashion that they did in the 60s, except now we've kind of tilted the scales into a different race. I mean, we saw that with the universities in the fall of the affirmative action. Everybody was like, people were thinking, oh, it's black versus white. It's like, actually, the Asian Americans were the ones that were being and whites and everyone else were being discriminated as part of that affirmative action. It was Asian Americans that weren't getting seats into Harvard because their acceptance was skewed and percentages thrown around. And, it's like, people shouldn't be punished based on their skin color,
Well, ideally, if you're truly interested in being progressive and truly interested in being inclusive, then you would include everybody as opposed to trying to right the wrongs of the past by recreating the wrongs of the past only on the flip side of the coin. I think a question that I have for you, though, because to be honest, your story, I have a friend who is also a musician, he's got a decade on you, and he's been around and working, swimming in these circles, but now he, I feel really bad because he's talking about his day drinking, just because, he wants to work and he loves to work, but he can't find work, and it's not enough that he's gay. Or that his partner is black, but, he doesn't check all the right boxes. And even he said to me, months and months ago, he just said, I'm having difficulty. I mean, there's no work for me anywhere. And, then I speak to, some colleagues from mine from like back in the day, and they have these crazy stories, where, we have one person who went to the same conservatory that we did, who apparently has made a business out of coming into these companies and having the ensemble sign some sort of a contract, I guess some sort of safety clause or something, that all the precious, delicate, fragile minorities and women will be taken care of throughout the process. And I hear that a lot of white professionals just go along with it because it's not really hurting me that much. Oh, what is it? They're helping out. And, it's just, it is what it is. But I can't imagine that these sorts of measures and this kind of divisive ideology isn't causing some subterranean issue. So I guess the question I'm coming to is, do you sense a sense of resentment or bitterness? Has morale been diminished by all of this? I mean, do you and your white colleagues even feel, I mean, do you even talk about this stuff? Do you feel comfortable talking about it? Like what's going on there, or your sense of what's going on?
Clifton, I have almost a day-to-day conversation with a lot of people through Facebook Messenger, women, men, black people, I mean, everyone. I talk on the phone with people. Morale is not good for theater. Even the people of color, even the people who are women, even the people who fit in these categories that these organizations say they represent, the morale is not good. I have friends that are actually exiting theater and doing, I have a friend who's a music director and was told that they're looking for non-white people for certain, for music directing. And so he's just started working with artists and touring with them and working on their albums and stuff, because that seems to be more his speed. As far like, you know, socially and politically. I have a friend in Florida, he's a music director, and they wanted a black conductor to conduct the show and asked him to step aside. So I said, why haven't you said anything? Why haven't you? But people are afraid. People are afraid to get canceled. People are afraid to have conversations on the internet about this publicly. People are afraid to challenge the narrative because they don't want to get canceled. They don't want to lose work. They'd rather go with the flow, nod their heads, smile politely. But then behind the scenes, we're all bickering and being like, what is going on? And who is going to step up and stop and kind of stand up to the bullies and challenge them? And, you know, that's why I really love your podcast and what you stand for, because you're not afraid to speak your mind, and you're not afraid who hears it. You want people to hear this, because what we're doing right now is challenging the narrative and not just sitting here and swallowing it and shrugging our shoulders and saying, oh, well, I guess, you know, this is how it is. I'm going to walk away with my tail between my legs and not speak up. I'm like, I'm not that person. You don't seem like that person. And, you know, it's people like us that are going to help move the needle a little bit and to, you know, to challenge these people. I mean, you know, after I sent my Maestra email, they responded with an attorney and a demand letter, and they threatened to take me to court for defamation of character of their organization for my discrimination video I made and the claims that I made that they were discriminating and what they were doing. And so they demanded that I take my YouTube video down and that I stop talking about this with them, about them in this way. And I felt like, you're trying to silence me now. You're trying to violate my right to free speech and my right to talk out against your organization for your bias. And so I consulted my attorney, and he said, make a response video. So I made a second video, and I published the demand letter publicly that the lawyer made, and I put it out there. And I was like, okay, here are the facts. Here are screenshots. I released everything that I had. I showed that their president and founder threatened my business back in February. And I showed that there's been a pattern of this with this organization and with the people who run the organization. And that it's not something, you know, what I would have liked to seen is Georgia reaches out and be like, hey, you know, that's not our intention. We're really sorry you feel that way. Something administrative, but complete silence, not talking to me. They blocked me on Facebook. They blocked me. I still have ways to see it, but they've blocked me in all the areas. The people who run me, like, they don't talk to me anymore because I challenged them. And you know what? They can't have a conversation because they don't have a foundation to stand on, because it's all a house of cards, and all it takes is a 5-minute conversation to poke holes through a lot of what they're doing, and it collapses. And they don't want to lose their $50,000 a year grant that they get from the New York City Council on the Arts. This maestro gets 50 grand a year to do what they do from New York. And, you know, that was the end for me. I filed a claim of discrimination with the New York City Human Rights, the organization, the Division of Human Rights for New York. And there's like a pending investigation now for it because, you know, we had to file articles of stuff and proof and all that, and they had to get their lawyer. And so right now it's a pending an investigation. And, you know, this is not American values. This is like a cult. And you know, the fact that, you know, somebody like Georgia keeps posting stuff on Facebook about, you know, men have this, women have that, look what women aren't getting. And it's all this extreme percentages and bean counting. And it's like, you know, maybe there's no women on Broadway doing the shows because some of the musicals just suck. Have we ever thought of that? Maybe the context of what you're writing about isn't appealing to an audience. Maybe it has nothing to do with the fact that you have a vagina or that you're a woman or that you're black or that you're Asian. Like, maybe that has nothing to do with it. Maybe it's just you're not writing good stuff. Well, and that's why you're not getting to work, you know?
Well, you can't ever say that. I remember some years ago, there was a show called Holla If You Hear Me. And if people don't know about this show, it was a show that was based on the music of Tupac Shakur, the late Tupac Shakur. And it was directed by a very prominent black director whose name I will not share in deference to the libel laws. But the show was just not good. And I remember I was doing some play at some play off Broadway. I was in tech for it. And they sent me the script because Chad Bozeman had done the workshops for this thing. But he decided he was going to go off and be a movie star, which is probably a pretty good career decision. And they were looking for someone to play the role that he played. And it was one of the leads, the role that he played in the workshops. And it took me 2.5 days to even get through the script. And even then, I'm sitting in the post office at 145th Street in Harlem. And by the way, if anyone lives up there and you have to go to that mail, post office for any reason, make sure you go between 10 to 15 minutes before they close, because then they'll actually move fast and get done what you need to get done. That said, I'm in this post office and I'm on the phone with my friend Jared, who was in the workshops and was moving on to the Broadway show. And I said, Jared, you know, because I'd read American Idiot, and I saw the script for that, and I just was like, okay. But then I also saw the production, so I was like, okay, maybe there's something I'm missing in the translation from page to stage. And I said, yo, Jared, am I missing anything? Like, is this, I don't understand this script. He's like, nah, man, really, you know, you ain't even got to finish reading it, dog. Like, you can come in and just like, you'll be brilliant. Just make some choices and you'll be brilliant. And I saw the show and I was like, oh, this is so not good. I mean, I had a gigantic gin and tonic because I knew some of the bartenders at the show and they hooked me up. And the show killed my buzz. That's how bad it was. But so much of the press afterward, it was like the director saying that, well, we knew that Broadway wasn't ready for, you know, for this kind of musical. And meanwhile, In the Heights has already been nominated for Tony. It's been running forever. Hamilton was already getting all the buzz anyway. So this idea that Broadway was not ready for hip hop or for black artists or whatever was just preposterous. But you know, but of course, as soon as you begin to levy any kind of criticism about a show like that, then of course the race thing pops up. That's just one thing. You know, it's really tough because everything you're saying and what you're talking about, you know, it leads me to this question of, you know, will a pendulum ever swing back? And my opinion is that it will not. And the reason I feel that way is because, you know, we focus, I think, a lot on, you know, on the politics of it. And we talk about left and right and red and blue. And, you know, I've certainly done my fair share of adding to the noise. But we're really talking about an ideology. And when you're talking about people who, you know, you talk about how they not only they can't talk about these things, they won't deal with any sort of conflict or confrontation. You know, they have no grounds to act the way that they do. Their arguments are flimsy. They have none, but they don't feel like they need any. Why? Because they are standing on what they feel is a moral high ground. I mean, you use the term cult, and I feel the same way as well. But you know, you said before, people like Miss Stitt, they will say, hey, nice career you got there. It'd be a shame if anybody heard about these things that you said, which totally aren't racist at all, but somebody might be offended and interpret it as racist or misogynist. And then there goes your career. So of course, there's going to be a whole culture of silence and really passive aggression. We're all bitchy theater people, you know, behind closed doors. But the fact that the industry itself is so unstable, so you never know where your next job is coming from. The fact that it's so relationship heavy and so reputation heavy means that nobody wants to be caught with their pants down having the wrong opinion. So you sort of have to shut off your brain, any sort of critical thinking faculty you may have, just to maintain a career. And I guess I'm arguing that when you do that to people and you force them to lie, you know, to themselves and to the world, because your belief system is becoming ever more absurd and ridiculous, it has a demoralizing effect. And I think that's, and you know, you mentioned people talking to you, they reach out to me as well. And like, nobody feels good about where the industry is right now. And I certainly, I mean, we're dealing with an ideology that's led to tens of millions of dead people over the 20th century alone. So I don't think they're going to stop at a few bad shows. But you know, I don't know how you feel about it. It's not really a question there. It's just a matter of like, you know, what we're doing is that we're attacking an ideology. And, you know, this ideology is, I mean, it is cult-like. And if you say mm-hmm. anything about it, then you get, it's now so sophisticated now, because it's not just about denouncing you as a racist. They're going to send your lawyers after you. They're going to have people online tarnishing your reputation. They might send some journalists after you. And so no one will say anything. And I've written this before, but this is what happens with all totalitarian regimes. They insulate themselves from feedback, either internally or externally. And then they end up dying because there's no mechanism for course correction. So that's my sort of rant on that. I'm sure you have many things to say in response.
Well, it's not sustainable. What they're doing is not sustainable. It will eventually end. I just don't know when or how, or it's gonna take time for it to evolve and devolve into like, well, this isn't the approach, this isn't gonna work, you know. But I don't think any of these people are gonna have a coming to Jesus moment of being like, you know what, we fucked up all these years, I guess maybe we should have allowed everyone and not just, you know, gatekept. They're not gonna have that, because their beliefs are being fueled by these figures they find online, or by, you know, whatever the belief they have about the world, you know, that there's some, you know, oppressive white man is keeping them out of these spaces. So we're going to rise up above them and, you know, and rise above oppression. And it's a David and Goliath moment. And it's like, yeah, well, you know, that's not what's happening. But they're fueling their beliefs with these statistics they post constantly. I mean, the Dramatists Guild is in on it. The Dramatists Guild had, I mean, that was my first intro to this whole thing, was they released this PDF called The Count, where it wasn't just Broadway, but they counted all the artistic directors and the people who have, you know, these positions across the country in different theaters throughout the country. And they released this publication with all these statistics. And they said, well, we can't help but deduce from these statistics that there's an implicit bias. And I'm like, well, we're assuming that based on these numbers. Like, you tell us in your research that, well, we can only come to the conclusion that there's an implicit bias. And I'm like, what? I mean, they even have another, I opened it up, but there's another it's an indoctrination. There's an anti-racist theory training slideshow on the Dramatists Guild's website. And it's this massive PowerPoint presentation about what you can say, what you can't say, how to approach anti-racist thinking and race wars and all this stuff. And it's like, this is like, you're indoctrinating us. Like, this is, we're artists, we're creators. That's what this is about. It's about art and creation. That's it. You're not entitled to be on Broadway because you fit a box. You know what I mean? It's like, it's an art form. It's art. It's going to be messy because human beings are messy. We are all messy as just thinking beings. You know, someone cuts you off in traffic. You don't think of flipping a bird and giving a few motherfuckers and throwing some slurs out. I mean, that's like, you get cut off in traffic, you're gonna let shit fly. Because we're human. That's what humans do. We're imperfect beings. But I think the way forward is that a lot of people are going to bow out of the industry, myself included, and just find other creative interests, you know, like you're doing with your one-man play. And, you know, you're just carving your own path away from the chaos of the commercial, corporatized and you know, discriminatory powers that be. But it's going to bite them in the ass at some point legally. You know, it already has with the sign language interpreter for The Lion King a few years ago was a white man, and he was actually asked by The Lion King to step down as a sign language interpreter to let a black person take the position of doing the ASL show because there's black people in the show. And so he actually sued the people at The Lion King for discrimination, and he won, and he settled out of court. And but he got so much hate and death threats and everything. But it's like, but this man needs to make a living too. Yeah. You know, such an elementary, like small-minded way of viewing things in that, well, there's black people in this show, there must be a black music director. It's like, that's so simplified and obtuse. Like, it's just so small-minded. Well, I don't also, know how to explain it.
It is, you know, and this friend I was telling you about earlier talked about how, you know, in the wake of the 2020 uprisings, now I'm told that all white creative teams now are forbidden. And I'm thinking to myself, well, then a show like The Scottsboro Boys, which really changed my life in a lot of ways, I mean, it's a flawed show, but it's a very powerful show. I mean, you know, an all-white creative team that never would have made it to Broadway. You know, people would never have known about that story who didn't know about it before. And so they're really shooting themselves in the foot with these kinds of arbitrary rules. You know, it's very short-sighted. And, you know, I want to go back to this idea about people leaving the industry because it's something I've been thinking about for a while. I spoke to an old mentor of mine. This was back in 2020 before all the craziness happened. And, or it was in the midst of it all, I should say. And he was talking about, you know, he's a fight director. And he was talking about how his director friends who are established and accomplished are, you know, they're finding work elsewhere. I mean, I'm hearing stories of multiple people now who are just saying, no, forget this. And it reminds me of what people talk about when they talk about one of the issues with, say, mass immigration, where people, you have sympathy because they're leaving a bad situation or a bad country. But if all of the enterprising and smart and self-possessed people leave, then who is left behind? And I think about what's happening with the theater industry at right now. And I'm thinking to myself, how many, you know, I mean, it's already a hard enough life. It's already unstable. You don't make a lot of money doing it. I mean, that used to be the thing is where we do it for the love, not for the money, but now the show must go on is now a racist and outdated adage, unfortunately, to these people. But, you know, so people are already kind of have one foot out the door unless things are going really, really well. So I'm thinking to myself, well, if you've already destroyed the economy of the industry, which, you know, I was trying to warn against and nobody was listening, and you've instilled or imposed these ridiculous ideological strictures on people, which is, I think people are just saying, you know what, F this, I'm out. Who is left behind? I think it's, you know, is it going to be a bunch of privileged people who can afford not to work for long stretches of time? Is it going to be a bunch of ideologues and morons who actually buy into this stuff and who don't really have much in the way of intellect or ability, but they check all the right boxes, so they'll get jobs? And do you have in the remainder a bunch of terrified people who just kind of cower in the corner and don't say anything because, hey, you know, things are going well for me? You know, I push back against, you said something earlier where you were like, oh, you know, you're speaking out and people say that I'm brave and courageous, but you know, if I'm being really honest, I don't know if things were still going well for me. I mean, I don't know, you know, cause we're not in that situation because I physically can't shut up about certain things,
but
you know, I don't know if I would be as vocal as I am now if I didn't feel like I'd been purged. And I think that's kind of part of the problem as well, is people, not enough people to stand up and just say, this is bullshit. I know I'm not racist. You know I'm not racist. I'm not a sexist. You know I'm not sexist. I'm a straight man in musical theater, for God's sakes. So why would I have an issue with sexual minorities? I have it's the wrong line of work if that's my problem. Let's get past all of this. We know it's nonsense. And I feel like they're sort of trying to fix a problem that wasn't broken. I see this especially among Zoomers who are born after the year 2000, who are trying to tell someone like me that the industry in like the 90s and 2000s was like Jim Crow America. I'm like, no, dude, I literally had people telling me since I was 17 that if I work hard, you know, that I have a lot of potential and I'll make something of myself. And that's what I was doing until progressives came by and decided that I should be niggerized for not taking a shot I didn't need. And also because I don't buy into their ridiculous quote unquote progressive bullshit. So, you know, they're trying to fix something that really wasn't broken in the first place. And it's driving people to extremes. But do you see a huge brain drain occurring, or, you know, has it manifested itself in any way, do you think?
In Broadway, I mean, a lot of it's economy too. I mean, shows are just really expensive post COVID. To mount, I mean, you know, $20 to $30 million raised just to get it to opening night. It's a lot of money, and a lot of the shows I feel don't have the longevity that they have had. I mean, we see Spamalot's closing, Sweeney Todd just announced they're closing. You know, a lot of shows don't sustain. And I think that's going to be I think that's the norm now. I don't think we're going to get back to pre-COVID. I think it's going to be shows are going to open 2-3 months, you know, 400 performances, 200 performances, and then close and then have a life somewhere else.
So it's regional theater, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of the producers that I'm friends with, they're looking to actually outsource and invest in West End productions or shows. You know, I keep getting a lot of decks, just basically like a, you know, pamphlet of what the show's about and how much it costs and all that. But I've been getting a lot of decks from producers for UK productions of stuff. And a lot of people are taking their shows. You know, Broadway's not, I don't think is going to be the holy grail of theater for people to want to, you know. I think the reason it's a holy grail is just because it gets the traffic to it, because it's in the city. Just by nature of where it's located, you're gonna draw people because you're getting eyeballs on your marquees. There's theater there. I mean, that's what it is. But I think, you know, COVID is, you know, when COVID happened, it's basically like we took a snow globe and shook it and displaced everything. And now you're seeing, you know, music pockets and theater pockets popping up in like Texas and Tennessee and Chicago. I mean, you're seeing these new places where new growth is happening in theater. So I don't think Broadway is going to like completely fail, but I think it's just a bunch of self-fulfilling musicals they're doing. They're writing shows just for themselves. They don't give a fuck about the audience. They're just like, look at me. It's about me. It's about me having autism, like the Ohio show. It's about me having this. It's about me having that. And like, look at me. I'm this color or I'm not. You know, it's all about that. You know, I'm waiting for a Down syndrome musical because we need to include them in something, you know? Well, and it's...
Who's going to play in the pit on that one?
Georgia.
Well, you know, it's a horrible joke to make. I know we're both.
You know what? It's we're allowed to joke. You know, we need to give ourselves permission to laugh at some of this. Otherwise, if we take it too seriously, then we go to dark places.
We're doing fucking plays. You know what I mean? It's not that serious. But you know, I do have to say that it's really interesting because I have felt for a while now. And, you know, I mean, even going back a decade, I began to feel a bit out of place in the industry because I felt like these people are making shows for themselves. They're not making mm-hmm. shows for the audience, for the mass audience. And, you know, I was doing this research for this article that I wrote just, and there was some Pew research that came out a few years ago that looked at the political makeup of the country. And I was pretty surprised to find that they said that even among registered Democrat voters, people who consider themselves very liberal only comprise about 15% or so. And, you know, everyone else is either they're conservative or very conservative by like 14%. But then there's like the moderates who are like 38% and the liberals who are 33%. So I'm thinking to myself, the entire industry is run by and catering toward this tiny sliver of the population. And then they wonder why people aren't coming to their shows. And like you said, I've noticed as well, and I'm very heartened by this, that there are other hubs popping up. You know, I'm hearing about Tennessee. I'm hearing about Texas. I'm surprised I haven't heard more about Florida since so many New Yorkers moved down there. But, you know, I kind of feel the same way that New York is just not it anymore. And one of my objections, you know, we talk about COVID, we talk about the pandemic, and, you know, I want to remind people that none of this had to happen. None of it had to be that way. And one of the reasons I hear the UK is sort of becoming that place is because they didn't go anywhere near as crazy with their COVIDianism. Mm-hmm. And also they're a little bit less ridiculous as far as politics. But the whole point is that, you know, I mean, I call it the city formerly known as New York for a reason. And I think mm-hmm. one of the reasons is that the artists in that city, and it pisses me off to no end, the artists in that city, so-called artists, especially the theater artists, particularly the Broadway community, this is we're talking about an institution that is integral to the cultural fabric and identity of the city and its economy, frankly. And yet they decided for 2 years that they're not essential. And I'm thinking to myself, how can you call yourself non-essential when people come from all over the world to see and to be in your shows? And the last time I was in New York was a few weeks ago. And I got really, really resentful. Because I said, why is it that these people get to have Juilliard? They get to have Alvin Ailey. They get to have the Met Opera. They get to have the Met Museum. They get to have the Public Theater and all these places. They get to have this, and they're mismanaging them so badly. And they're failing, and they can't see why they're failing. They won't allow themselves to see it. And yet they get all this because it's like you were saying, it's New York. It's got that brand. It's got that prestige. And I think that it's better than not that talent is leaving the city for practical reasons and going elsewhere, because what it means is that highly trained, top caliber artists are moving out of the city and taking their magic to different parts of the country. And I think in the long term, that's going to be better for theater culture in general, because I just feel like New York, it's not really an environment anymore where innovation and the creation of timeless classics really happens anymore. I don't mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know.
Well, there was I don't remember the exact title, but there was a scholarly article that I actually purchased because I was really interested in it. It was talking about the corporatization of Broadway, and it was trying to show how when you corporatize art to, you know, does it become meritless? And does it start to take on a different shape, and it starts to be about more about commerce and less about artistic freedom? And back, I think, in the 90s, when, you know, Times Square and everything got revamped, you know, Disney bought a theater, and that's where it, like, kind of started, where it started to become, you know, there was no risk taking anymore because there's too much on the line now. There's investors on the line. There's a lot involved. So I feel Broadway is more, you know, all 41 of those theaters, it's about trying to just get an audience and get familiar IP. It's a game. It's not really thinking about the art. You know, the producers would rather change the end of a show so that way people leave on a good note and feeling great than actually stick to the story or the intention of the authors. You know, they would rather do that in Broadway. You can't take as many risks, I feel, creatively in New York, not just because of the economy, but also now it's like, you know, I feel you have to walk on eggshells. You know, what can I say? What can't I say? Can I take risks in a rehearsal room? You know, if I have to, you know, I had a friend who did, she did a writing workshop, and they did a performance, and they were kind of like twisting. They had to write a song in the style of a composer, and they could rewrite the lyrics and everything. And so my one friend wrote a song, and she used the word drag queen in the show, in the song. And this actor that was hired was really upset that she had to say the word drag queen in the lyrics. And the actor wanted to make a creative decision to change it to say homo instead of drag queen. Because it took place somewhere, I think the song they wrote was set in somewhere in San Francisco or in some other part. And I'm like, this is the culture that is the bedrock right now. In these spaces where, again, it's a sense of entitlement. I don't feel I should say. It's like, yeah, but it's not about you and your identity. It's about you have to play that damn act, that damn person that's on stage every night. You know, you have to take on that character regardless. You basically have to sever your person in some way and your values and find yourself in that character. And if you can't, then you shouldn't be working in there. They should have fired the actress, but I think she sang it, and eventually the authors changed the lyric and they performed it at some cabaret night or something. But it's like, you know, that's the culture that's coming out of New York right now. And yeah,
I got to cut in because this is why I say the pendulum isn't swinging back, because it's not just coming out of New York. And part of the issue is it's also coming out of academia. Mm-hmm. And academia is now a pipeline into the industry in a way that it wasn't before. And my friend, he was telling me that of this extraordinary story of this actor who did not want to perform a certain scene or line or something because they didn't feel safe doing it. Not physically unsafe, but, you know, there was some psychological whatever. But there's a professor at some university, which is a pretty prominent university, if you want to be a musical theater star. And there's only a handful. You can probably guess out of three guesses which one it is. But this professor is a sexual minority and makes that a part of their, you know, their whole kind of ethos. And this person is actually training the next generation, like, you know, future generations of performers about, you know, just about, I mean, it's good if you're an actor to have boundaries, obviously, because people can take advantage of you really, and your openness and your mm-hmm. free, you know, nature very easily. And you have to have safeguards against that. But it's one thing to say, I'm not doing this scene because it's full nudity and I'm not showing my mound or my twig and berries. I'm not doing it. It's another thing to say, you know, I don't want to do any sex scenes. But it's a whole different thing to say, well, this scene, I'm not going to do it because as a straight white person or whatever, a cis hetero, whatever, I feel that if me saying this thing is so offensive and harmful, yada, 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 I don't feel safe, or I don't think I'm making other people safe. And the point that I'm getting at is that, you know, we have kids now, every year now, the industry is being flooded anew with all these bright, shiny BFAs and MFAs who've never struggled. You know, I can't say, you know, you can't make broad sweeping statements, but who just have spent nearly, you know, anywhere from 16 to almost 20 years in school and not really having worked on anything. And they're in schools that are teaching them, indoctrinating them with like terrible ideas and ideology. And even before all this stuff began to happen, I remember my grad school teachers were like, you know, we're having a harder and harder time finding young people who are able to break themselves open and really have the courage to live in these really, I mean, you know, Tony Kushner once said that as an actor, you know, the audience is pretty much paying you to suffer. That's what the audience is coming to watch. They're watching to see you suffer. And you have to have the capacity to take all that on, whether you're doing tragedy or comedy. And I think it seems like we're creating now a culture of people who can't sustain any kind of difficulty. So for me, I'm like, well, I don't want to work with you. Sorry, but if we're doing Sweeney Todd and violence makes you squeamish, or, you know, sexual assault makes you, you can't deal with it, then please find another line of work. Please don't do this. One of the reasons that we're in this industry is because we're all weirdos and, you know, maybe we hear voices, whatever. Our parents didn't love us enough. But the top of the top, the best of us, understand that part of the cost of doing the work that we do is that you have to go into some prickly, difficult, emotional places sometimes. And it's your responsibility to be able to deliver yourself to these experiences and to open yourself up to these dark places and to be able to be a conduit for them. That's the tragedy of the human condition. And we have a culture now of people who they're more interested in themselves and their social media following and their own psychoses and neuroses than they are in actually serving the audience, which is their job. And that's why my pendulum ain't swinging back, because not in New York, because it's going to take people who are going to say, no, I'm tired of this. Go to therapy. Fuck off. We're here to do Richard III. I don't care about you. You know, I don't care about any of this other
nonsense. It's like, get a puppy and a lollipop and fuck off. You know what I mean? It's like, I think they're coddling too much to the younger generation, and they see these, you know, fake lives played out in social media, and, you know, this polished and pristine and perfect looking world. And it's like, look, people, the world's fucking messy. You know, look at Ukraine, look at Haiti, look at Israel and Palestine. That is real shit that is happening. And it's fueled by human conditions. Okay? Somebody like Putin is only out for himself and believes that Ukraine is part of Russia, and he is going to, it's a territory fight. It's a war against territory. And that we can all in some way relate to, you know, with territory. Even if you're a child, someone takes your toy. I mean, that's a different, I mean, it's not a dictator, but it's a different situation and circumstance, but that part of the human condition is in all of us. We all have those capabilities if you're emotionally intelligent enough, and if you're emotionally healthy enough. I mean, you have to have a thick skin in order to be in this industry. You got to deal with criticism. You got to deal with saying shit you actually don't believe, but your character is into. I mean, like, there are things that you have to do. And you're right. You know, if you're coming out of a BFA program and you're like, you know, the only horrible thing that's happened to you is someone spelled your name wrong on your Starbucks cup, you probably don't have much intelligence emotionally to really go that deep into
courage. It's really courage and depth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you need to have that visceral well and that deep well of emotion to pull from. I mean, I'm not an actor, but I'm assuming a lot of this, but you have to have that well to tap into. And if, you know, you're in a shallow end of the pool as a, you know, coming out of these programs, it's like, it's all surface. You know, it's like, we have to act like we're sad. Now we have to act like we're angry, or now it's not a visceral thing for a lot of these people. And that's why I feel like a lot of the shows that I see now on Broadway it's facting. It's fake acting, you know, and it's not. I honestly think that's why things like, you know, I saw Spamalot a few weeks ago, and the I forgot his name. He was in Aladdin, but he played the
James Monroe.
Yeah, he was, you know, it was in February, and they had a moment in the show where I forgot the character's name, but they instead of saying knight, they say Knigget on stage. Yeah, they say the word knight like as it looks, not as it's actually supposed to be said.
Was that in the show originally?
I do not know, but the one French guy was in Beetlejuice was said, be off Knigget or something, and the two actors on stage kind of looked at each other and like, did he say no? Nah. And then he broke character, broke the fourth wall, and turned to the audience and said, not during Black History Month. And I'm like, you've robbed this story. You've now selfishly injected you, and we're no longer dispelling belief now in Spamalot. You've now sucked everything out of that room, and now that's all I'm thinking about with that show. It's like, well, why did you say that? That's not a line in the show. You know, you broke forth, or you broke character to inject your own agenda in front of an audience of mixed people, people from Texas, people from all over the world. Like, it's so selfish to do that. And I feel like a lot of the actors today coming out of these programs are only thinking about me, what about me? I don't want to say that because I don't believe it. It's like, fuck you, get out of the industry. Go push coffee somewhere, you know, go take up a desk job, do something that isn't the arts, because arts are supposed to challenge us, you know?
Well, you know, it's tough for me because, you know, I mean, as an actor, one of the reasons I love Warren Beatty so much is because he's always been sort of very transparent about his self-centeredness. He's like, I want it very much to be bad, to be famous. And I look the best between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. So that's when we're doing my shot, my close-ups. but the thing about Beatty is that he's also ridiculously intelligent and inquisitive and curious. Highly, highly, highly smart man. I forgot why I said all that, but the main point that I wanted to say was that, you know, it's tough because, I mean, acting really is a very self-centered profession. And there's that great story between Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman when they were shooting Marathon Man. And apparently they were at lunch at one point, and they're in this nice restaurant. And Dustin Hoffman is just like, you know, why do we do it? Why do we put ourselves, like, why do we do this stuff? And apparently Laurence Olivier, one of the most celebrated, probably the most celebrated actor of the 20th century, just in this restaurant, gets over this table and just goes, look at me, 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 look at me. And that's kind of what it is. You know, you're there because you want to be seen. But at the same time, the paradox is that the cost of that, I mean, I had a teacher who coined a phrase, the arrogance of generosity. You have to be arrogant enough to presume that whatever you have to offer is worth looking at and listening to. But you also have to be generous with your talent, and you have to share whatever your experience is. And the irony is that when you're talking about a craft like acting, which requires so much of us, I mean, the industry in and of itself is hard enough, but the craft in and of itself, you know, you're doing the Scottish play, AKA Macbeth. And, you know, you have this scene where you learn that your wife and children have been slaughtered, you know, by this tyrant. And you have to put yourself through that experience every night of the show. And what does that feel like? What kind of, you know, and there's some nights you're like, man, I ain't feeling it tonight. There's some nights like, you know, every I did that play in the summertime a few years ago in an outdoor theater. And without fail, I mean, because it was the Old Globe, and the Old Globe was about 20 minutes away from the San Diego airport. So without fail, during that scene, it was like, thy wife and babes savagely slaughtered.
Oh.
You know, so, but you know, you have to find a way to hold your concentration, hold your focus, hold that sorrow within you, and have the discipline to kind of go through it. But we're now in an industry and in an era where we're focusing so much on the superficial aspects. What sex are you? Who do you like to sleep with? You know, what is your race? that we're leading to people who are just only focusing on the surface and not what's going on underneath. And it's a whole culture of people now who've been trained to look only at superficial attributes. And it's just, it's leading to very surface level work. And I think audiences are feeling that. And that's why they're saying, I'm not coming to your show, but I will give money to this one Black guy who's putting on a solo show and doesn't hate us. It's really, really, it's just a shame.
Yeah. You've amassed a lot through that. And I can't wait to see that. I think it's something we all have been, the audience obviously is craving that, that level of craft. And you're right. I've even before COVID, I felt like a lot of the work has been surface. You know, I feel like Broadway is kind of tripping over itself. It doesn't really know what it wants to be. And it's, you know, trying to throw things at the wall and see if it sticks and, you know, but I think that's why a lot of things are closing too now. I mean, you know, I didn't see How to Dance in Ohio, but, you know, and I know that there are people who saw it that felt really validated that they saw themselves on a stage. And I don't want to take that away from them. And I'm glad that they were able to do that. But it closed. And I feel like for people to, wherever you live in New York, if you're in New York or New Jersey or whatever, and you're driving or you're commuting and you're paying $200 a ticket, paying for food. And now they're putting in the whole congestion pricing thing for people who drive in under 60th Street. With all those elements combined, the show really needs to pull its weight in order to draw those people, you know, especially if you bring like a family of four to see a show, like you're going to spend $1,000 on just seeing the musical and getting dinner and doing all those other things. And, you know, I don't think How to Dance, I think it would have done better somewhere else, but or just stayed as a documentary because I don't know. I think it's like, you know, who hasn't been on stage? Let's put them in it and put them on there. And I'm like, but you're getting a mixed audience. So, you know, it's very difficult, I think, to sustain doing what they're doing. I don't like most of the stuff on Broadway right now because it's just like, meh.
Well, apparently almost no one else does either, but they have a more diverse audience than ever. So there is that. Kevin, how can people find you?
Oh, God. So most of my stuff is on my website, www.kevinlynchnj.com. Or if you YouTube me, I have a YouTube channel, just YouTube my name and I'm sure I'll pop up.